You know, the CIA assisted a rebellion in Indonesia in 1958, in which at one time I myself ordered the delivery of 42,000 rifles. I mean, that's not a covert operation, you see. We were using submarines against the south coast of the islands of Indonesia, not a covert operation. So the military looked very carefully at these things and knew that the CIA was going much too far. We supported the Khamba people in Tibet, something like 60 or 70,000 of them, by dropping arms to them, medicine, weapons, everything to those people. That's not covert, but we thought it was. You know, we put it under the rules of CIA's operation. And this is what Kennedy was facing during that transition from the Eisenhower time, when the CIA had begun to get into all these things, the Indonesian rebellion, the Tibetan program, the Cuban program, all were in that period of time, and Kennedy inherited that. And at the same time, General Ridgway, who died just a week or two ago, told Kennedy clearly, don't ever let Americans come into Asia. Don't ever bring American soldiers into Asia. And General Bradley, I used to be General Bradley's personal pilot, and I know the gentleman, one of the finest men ever put a uniform on. He gave Kennedy the same answers. Eisenhower, in this book here on the foreign relations of the United States, says how bitterly he opposes the entry of American divisions into Vietnam. If I've tabbed that page, it's very interesting. This, by the way, is the foreign relations of the United States, Vietnam, August to December 1963, zeroing right in on the peak of the time of Kennedy's involvement in the planning for the future in Vietnam. And anybody that wants to think that Kennedy was not deep into the activities in Vietnam doesn't realize that during this period of that time, there were meetings going on day after day after day in the White House, in which my own boss, General Victor Krulak, was involved, Maxwell Taylor was involved, McNamara was involved, and what that would mean is when they'd come back to the office, the rest of us and the Joint Staff were involved supporting the President in the development of these plans, because he knew that he was either going to have to make the decision, as he did in NSAM 55,
right,
to get the CIA out of this covert work, and with the CIA out of, say, the operation in Vietnam, he saw no role for the military. Huh. And it was perfectly logical from the Kennedy point of view and from what the Joint Chiefs of Staff had told him, that we should not be in Vietnam. And when he wrote this document, which, because of our movie JFK, Oliver Stone's work, where we introduced the subject of the National Security Action Memorandum number 263,
right,
which was written and signed on October 11th, 1963, saying that that all U.S., all American personnel would be out of Vietnam by the end of 65. That was Kennedy's decision after all of this work spanning this period of 6 months. And here you can read day by day by day the meetings were, well, I counted over 50 meetings that are listed in this book, in which my own boss, General Krulak, attending meetings with President Kennedy on Vietnam. And as Kennedy worked his Vietnam policy out during that period, he arrived at what you might call a scenario. He wanted to be sure everybody understood what he was doing. So he sent General Krulak quickly to Vietnam. The idea being, published in the papers, that he was going to get the last minute word in Vietnam to see how things stood.
That was in late August, or?
Late August. I think he actually traveled in September,
okay,
because I myself was sent to the SINCPAC headquarters in Hawaii to meet with Admiral Felt, and I have yet never revealed the reasons for that meeting, but the two had a very strong, I was doing a lot of writing for General Krulak, and they were very much related. And when General Krulak came back, he met with Kennedy and discussed up to date the things he heard from the people out there, which of course we knew by telephone anyway, but it made the scenario more reasonable. And so immediately Kennedy ordered Maxwell Taylor and McNamara to go to Vietnam. And so they went late in September, I believe it is. After a very busy flying trip, going all over the country, talking not only to President Diem, but to his opposition, because by that time, Diem had some serious opposition in his country, they came back. Well, they had brought a big trip report for the president. Now, it's absolute fantasy to think that two busy men like General Taylor and Mr. McNamara are going to make a quick flying trip all through Vietnam, transversing the Pacific Ocean and everything, and write a great trip report while they go. It would be written right in the Pentagon. But more importantly, it was being written as a result of these meetings, and Kennedy was dictating the policy daily to these people that he met with, his staff in the White House, people from State Department, people from CIA, and the military. And when McNamara and Taylor got back to Hawaii, a jet carrying the report landed in Hawaii and gave it to him, a big document with leather covered, with President John F. Kennedy on the cover and all that sort of thing. They couldn't possibly have done that while they were traveling. And then they had the time to review the report as they flew back to Washington, usually an 8-hour, 45-minute trip in those days, in one of the Air Force One aircraft. And they left Andrews Field in a helicopter. They arrived on the White House lawn and presented it to the president. It had just left him about 2 days earlier. And here was the trip report. That's October 2nd of 1963. And that trip report contains the information that Kennedy had approved, that he was going to bring 1,000 men home by Christmas time. That's 1,000 military men. And by the end of 65, the bulk of U.S. personnel. Now, bureaucracy is an interesting thing. We learn what certain words mean. If he had said he would bring home the bulk of American military personnel, you would assume that the military personnel were there. So he'd bring in America. And most people who write about that period say Kennedy was going to bring home or not bring home. They were going to withdraw the soldiers. Well, they weren't going to withdraw them. They weren't there. Withdrawal is not the word. That's wrong. And many people have been writing for The Nation magazine and other magazines like that, trying to explain Kennedy's mind, overlooked the fact that we very carefully inserted into that document, bring home the U.S. personnel. And what did that mean? The CIA people were coming on. So again, that lowered the boom on the CIA, and this time it was the last time. They were going to be out of covert operation completely. So NSAM 55 began the movement of getting CIA out, and 263 closed the book on it. And by 65, he would have had no CIA people in Vietnam at all. And they'd been there since 45. So you see a good long period of time, 20 years. And in other countries too, he would have stopped them from being in covert operations overseas. It's very fundamental points that if you look in the right books and at the right reports, you get them all, and they're all backed up. These are not my words. I happen to be there and I happen to be working in them. But this series, especially this latest book that has just been released, gives you the answers to what people have been looking for years. But the trouble is that during this period, countless history books have been written about Kennedy, about Vietnam, about the post-war period, about the Cold War. And the writers have not used this sort of material. And unfortunately, the books are, what will we call them, fantasy or mythology?
Concoction.
Incorrect. I belong to the Society of Historians for American Foreign Relations, a wonderful organization of thousands of mostly history professors all throughout the country. And as we have our annual meetings, one of the complaints that arises more frequently than any other is the quality of history books today. Quality meaning, are they true? Are they revisionist? There's more things been written about Kennedy that are absolutely untrue since his death. There's no sense of killing a guy twice, once with a gun and once with a typewriter. And they're untrue. And what I think people ought to do is refer to the work of these generals, like this report at the Bay of Pigs, or refer to these works, papers, from the State Department. They're listed as a foreign relations of the United States, and see what the facts are. Or refer to some of the gentlemen that are mentioned in here who are still with us, God bless them, because those are the important things. And that tells us what really happened. And this is why when I worked with Oliver Stone, we were working from this kind of paper, and that's what stirred up so much opposition. Yeah. Because when these big-time writers in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other papers said, there is no substantive history to back up what Stone's putting in the film, all I need to do is read these books. There's the substantive history. And it's appalling to think that these men who work every day on the minds of the American public with their computer writing through the New York Times and the Washington Post and the rest of them are telling us that sort of thing when they know very well what they're saying is not true. It's too bad, but it's not true.
And as you were saying before, the Taylor McNamara report, which became, in essence, the formalized text for 263, you were involved working under Krulak in writing a lot of what became their report that they gave back to Kennedy when they arrived on the White House lawn, that was derived from all these meetings.
Yes. And, you know, people have to understand, when you talk about the Joint Chiefs of Staff, there's an organization called the Joint Staff. Now, in my day, by law, it could not exceed 400 people. And so I was one of 400. And people say, well, what's your job? Our job is to do this kind of thing. When General Krulak would come back, he'd throw notes on the table before five or six of us, or even tape record, cassette recording. And he'd say, there's what we did today. Now look, each one of you do such and such a part you've been working on, and we'll get this report the way the president wants it. Right. And when it was the way the president wanted it, that's when it went out to Hawaii to Taylor and McNamara, so that when it came back, the president was ready to sign it as his policy for Vietnam, which was he was not going to put American troops into Vietnam. Where we put, do you know how many troops were really in Vietnam? 2,600,000. And 58,000 were killed, let alone all the other people that were killed.
By the time it was all done?
By the time the Vietnam War was over, 2,600,000 men had been rotated through Vietnam. We don't very often think about that. We dropped more bombs from aircraft in Vietnam, in Indochina, than all of World War II. People don't have any idea what Vietnam really got to be after the death of Kennedy. Well, in all of those big numbers that I'm talking about, the money that rolled out went at least to $570 billion. Now, if Kennedy had not died, he would not have put those people there. Not just the 500,000 that were there at any one given day, but the 2,600,000. And if the people didn't go, they would not have had to spend the $570 billion. Well, there are men, as General Eisenhower said in his great speech, which was the opening of the Stone film, that beware of the military-industrial complex. And when you threaten such a complex with the potential of $570 billion, and then you're going to bring it down to nothing, you are bound to get some hot-headed decisions. And the removal of the president is not a very difficult thing to do. Just think of the list of presidents who've been wounded, shot at, killed since World War II. A lot of people don't know that even President Carter was threatened with assassination. And President Reagan had a bullet in him. It's a very, very different world when we don't use things in a factual basis and really know what's going on, because then the public is so badly confused. Plus in debt. Confused and deeply in debt. You know, I don't have... My book is here. I don't know whether I can... But in the book, I could show you, just to make a point. because I knew the document, I inserted in this book of mine the picture of these men coming back to Washington with this report. It's on the coffee table in the president's office. And if anybody thinks that that huge report could have been written while they were running from one place to another in Vietnam, you see that big report on the coffee table in front of the president and Maxwell Taylor and McNamara there? That is the report of the trip. They couldn't have done that on the back of envelopes while they were running.
Right.
And it was very carefully designed by Kennedy to support his Vietnam policy, you
right.
see. He had no... It's like saying he was to blame for not providing air cover for the Cubans. Here's something people are saying he had no policy for Vietnam. He was going to... You know, the thing that's very interesting about Kennedy's death and this work... There was a meeting convened in Honolulu on the 20th of November, 1963. Very strange meeting because 60 leaders of our government, including the ambassador from Saigon, among others, and all of Kennedy's cabinet had gone to Honolulu. And they had this meeting about what to do in the future with the Vietnam War. Despite the fact that this existed, there was this meeting about the Vietnam War. The interesting thing is that the report that they released that day, November 20th, and published in the New York Times, among other papers, on the 21st, is a glowing report of how things were becoming better in Vietnam. And yet, on the same day, November 21st, 1963, a report was written called NSAM 273, which was reversing some of the Kennedy policy for Vietnam. And yet, hypothetically, this NSAM, new NSAM, would have to be signed by Kennedy. And yet the Honolulu meeting was providing Kennedy with assurances that everything was going well. So could it be that this NSAM 273 was somehow signaling a change, which of course by March of 1973, when NSAM 288 came out under Lyndon Johnson, escalated the war to what we saw later.
Now you said March of 83, you mean March of 64?
63. No, March of 64.
March
yes,
of 64.
Thank you very much. Okay. March of 64. But you can see the changes in it. And some of these people have said, again referring to the Kennedy policy of not putting America, not withdrawing America, but not putting Americans in. Withdrawal was bringing the boys home for Christmas, but not putting them in. They completely overlook this rapid change that came right about the time the president was killed. And to me, it just underscores terrifically the way history books are worked on.
Right.
In 1967, sort of summing up all of this Vietnam period, Secretary McNamara of the Defense Department ordered a group to write the history of the U.S. in Vietnam from 1945, notice the date he picks, 45, to the present. Right. And the present would be, when they got it done, the end of 1968. So, rather in a chronological manner, they wrote what amount to being five volumes this size of this history of the United States, a history written by people in the Pentagon, paid for by the U.S. government, and published by the U.S. government. It's called the Pentagon Papers. Because it is the same stack of highly classified papers that Daniel Ellsberg released to the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, and a few other papers. And, of course, Ellsberg got in serious trouble for violating security and releasing this, which, of course, was very good advertising for this. Because this was put together, as it states clearly in the opening paragraphs by a man named Les Gelb. Gelb was working in the internal security agency offices of the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
That's where he was working. It also just happens that if you look in the Pentagon telephone books of the period, you find that not only is Mr. Gelb listed in ISA, but Daniel Ellsberg is listed in the Pentagon telephone books. And anybody that has enough interest to want to read history should just look in these books, because a lot of other nice names in here. General Richard Secord was working in the same office. Mr. Eagleburger, the State Department, was working in the same office.
ISA.
Bill Bundy was working. Bill Bundy was the head of it for a while. ISA. They had a little robin's nest there that was bringing out all these things. But something that I want to emphasize on this business of history, because most history professors, and therefore, unfortunately, most history students, believe that the Pentagon Papers are the essence of the Vietnam War period, and that if they study these, they know what went on. And the book is written in chronology, like the page I'm open to here has the 3rd of November, the 4th of November, and over here on this page, 9th of November, the 20th of November, the Honolulu Conference, the conference I was talking to you about, with all the people out there. The entire country team met with Rusk, McNamara, Taylor, Bundy, Bell. So I have a letter, copy of a letter Bundy wrote in 1991. This is McGeorge Bundy, saying he wasn't there. He was listed. Maybe the history book's wrong. But it's real interesting. They right up to the 20th. Then on the 22nd of November, 1963, on a blank slate in the Pentagon, they wrote this. Lodge confers with the president. 22nd of November. Having flown to Washington the day after the conference, Lodge meets with the president and presumably continues the kind of report given in Honolulu. 23 November 1963, NSAM 273. Drawing together the results of the Honolulu Conference and Lodge's meeting with the president, NSAM 273 reaffirms the U.S. commitment to defeat the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. But what's missing? The men that wrote this wrote it in 1968. They hadn't heard that Kennedy had died. They didn't even know Kennedy was missing. When Lodge confers with the president, they didn't clarify whether he met with Kennedy or Johnson or neither. This is how history is written today. You see? And such things as that are very powerful in the minds of people in college today who are too young to know the things that I can remember about General Walter Beadle Smith or General Ridgway or General Bradley or Alan Dulles. I've worked in Alan Dulles' home with him. I know what Alan Dulles thinks about various things. I've worked with him in John Foster Dulles' home. Well, why can't we tell it the way it is? Why can't we tell it truthfully? So on the 22nd of November, according to this five-volume study done by 36 PhDs working with Les Gelb, who has been the managing editor of the New York Times, among other things, on the 22nd of November, they didn't even notice that the President of the United States had been shot. And the rest of our history books are just about that good. It's terrible. It's a disaster.